already rolling? Yeah, okay. Thanks for being here.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, I love what you do, and I thought, who better to ask? You were just telling me you pronounce your name Astrid,
yes,
correct?
Yes.
Not Astrid.
Yes.
Can you tell everybody why?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up on the East Coast after I was adopted. I'm guessing we'll get into that. But after I was adopted, my parents had not changed my name, and they kept my name, which is somewhat rare in adoptions. But we were older. And so we grew up on the East Coast, and there's not very many people here in the United States called Astrid. Well, the name is designed to be said Astrid, which is a Scandinavian Norwegian name. And for your listeners, they can't tell. I do not look Scandinavian, nor do I look Norwegian. And so people on the East Coast with really thick accents would say Astrid, New Yorkers, all the time. And I hated that. And I was teased a lot because I had a unique name. And, you know, I believe the teasing and my life experiences brought me to where I am today. But when we moved from the East, from Boston to Atlanta, I started telling everybody that in Colombia, we pronounce my name Astrid, which is not true. But nobody knew any different, so nobody challenged me. So there you have it.
So Astrid.
Astrid.
Mm-hmm. And what does it mean? Do you know what your name means?
I've been told it means, well, it definitely has to do with the stars, mm-hmm. and that I've been told it means shooting star. I like that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if you don't know, make something up.
I know, right? I could do that too, but that's what I've been told, shooting star, which, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, we're here to talk about Adoption Mosaic, and you alluded to the fact that you were adopted. Mm-hmm. Tell me about what that was like growing up, being adopted in a family. I know that's a very big question, but
yeah,
tell me about your childhood.
Yeah. Well, so before I talk about what it was like to be adopted, I like to explain to people, kind of paint the picture of how our adoption was set up for us to even come into care, and what my parents did, adoptive parents did to adopt us, because that piece of the story, I think, is just as valuable in the understanding why I do the work that I do. Mm. And so my parents were biologically not able to have children. We know statistically about 86% of first-time adopters adopt because of infertility. And so infertility was very much a piece of why they chose to adopt. They, like anybody else, just wanted to grow family and wanted to be parents, and that was the thing you did. And they, because they weren't able to do it biologically, they decided that they were going to look into adoption. Mm. And when they looked into the types of adoption at that time in the mid-70s, there were kind of two avenues: adopt through child welfare, foster care, or adopt internationally. And when it came to adopting internationally, they could choose which country and so forth. My parents had never traveled to Colombia, where my sister and I are from. When you ask my dad why they decided to adopt from Colombia, he says, well, because the process was quick and easy and we could have kids quicker, right? When you ask my mom, oh, Colombia is so beautiful. Everybody, all the people are beautiful. The landscape is beautiful. And there was a need. There was a high need to adopt, or a high need of children that needed care, that were aging out of orphanages. We didn't have foster care in Colombia. I don't know that there's foster care in Colombia even now. I don't think so. I think it's mostly orphanage-run adoptions. So my parents basically went to an agency and said, we want to become parents. And the agency you know, did a home study, did a couple things and charged them whatever and said, we've got this program in Colombia. That's the program that's the quickest right now and it'll get you kids pretty quick. And my parents were like, yeah, we don't really need to do the infant thing because we've been trying to have babies for about 10 years. So we will go ahead and adopt an older child. And then they said, well, wait a second. We want to have more than one kid. And the story is there's a lot more siblings that are stuck in the system because trying to keep them together, they oftentimes get separated. And so they decided that they would adopt a sibling group to keep us together and for their purpose to have more than one child. And so they adopted, I was 4 and a half when I arrived and my sister was 6. We grew up our whole life not knowing our real birthdays, we made some assumptions. The orphanage actually gave us all the same birthday, so they only had to celebrate one birthday a year. So my sister and I believed that we had the same birthday exactly a year apart before we found out that we actually didn't know our birthdays and that was the standard practice at the orphanage to give us, those of us who came in without birthdays. To give us birthdays. And I have since found my birth mom, and they were a year and 1 month off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so pretty big difference when you're little. Now it just means maybe I get to retire.
Do you...
I mean, you sometimes got to laugh at this stuff, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Do you have memories about meeting your parents for the first time? Did they fly to Colombia and come and get you?
Yeah, no. We were escorted to the United States by a social worker. My parents were instructed to not fly to Colombia because they were in a civil war. It wasn't a safe place for people from the United States to travel there. So my parents received referral pictures, is what we call them, and said, here are the two girls that are available. What do you think? They said yes. And within about 2 months, we were on a plane with Colombian passports coming to the United States. I don't remember meeting them for the first time. I have one memory in the orphanage in Bucaramanga, where my sister and I were with my sister. I have this memory. And then I have the memory of those first days of living with Norm and Chris. My mom and dad, I only call them Norm and Chris for clarification, not my birth parents. But I have some memories in those first days of cultural shock kind of memories, if you will. Remember how much food was available. I remember the refrigerator. It was like you would open these two doors and there would be like this shining light and there was all this food. And my parents had been instructed, your girls are going to come and they probably haven't seen an abundance of these kind of things. And so just be prepared. And you know, we highly recommend you just let them eat whatever they want. And apparently my dad loves to tell the story that we would eat. Neighborhood kids would come over the house to watch us eat because we would eat like 4 hot dogs and we were little. We were tiny. We were 25 pounds when we came to the United States. So, yeah. So I remember things like that. I remember also being scared, wanting my sister to be with me and next to me all the time, but really around food. I remember the food stuff a lot more than anything else. So growing up, your original question of growing up and being adopted, my parents are white, and we grew up moving an average of every 5 years. And so we were a conspicuous family. We screamed adoption. If I wanted to be private about the fact that I was adopted, that wasn't a choice I had. Right. And because we moved all the time, we were always the educators. We were always the people that were having to explain our family, justify our family. Yes, no, he's my brother. Because my parents, 3 months after we arrived, 3 months after we arrived, our mom was pregnant with our little brother, Tony. So they did have a bite.
So your brother looks like your parents and you and your sister don't. So
correct.
more questions from people on the street. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and as you can imagine, as we when we were little, holding our parents' hands and the visual attachment that people saw that we had sitting on mom or dad's lap, and it was clear that we were their children, even though we weren't matching racially, and that we played with Tony as if he was our little brother. So it was pretty clear. It was the problems came as we got older. And if we moved to a new town, and we moved when I was in middle school, and then I stayed in the same middle school and high school. And my brother, who was 4 years younger than I was actually, he was 5 years, but I'm used to saying, growing up, saying that he was 4 years younger than I was. It started getting to people asking if he was my boyfriend or inappropriate things. And then as an adult, when I am with my father, who looks like a just regular old white guy, right? and people don't assume that he's my dad. And that kind of sucks, honestly. You know, like, I want to be able to put my arm in his arm. And I do, because I'm at the place in my life where I just don't care. And I know that people are making the assumption that that I'm his male order bride, or that I'm his, you know, whatever. And that makes me sad, because we deserve to be seen by other people as a father-daughter team. My mother, they've historically, I feel like they think that I'm there to help her, maybe be her, her maid, or I'm there to carry her groceries, or, you know, it's just, there's not an assumption that I'm her daughter. So it's ongoing, right? I mean, this is one of the reasons I built Adoption Mosaic and the work I do, is because it's deep, and these are things that nobody knows how to talk about. They don't have language to talk about it.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about growing up. I mean, it's already enough to grow up and go through being a teenager and then become an adult. I mean, did you have sort of, not an identity crisis, but have a moment where you were like, who am I? What's my culture? Where am I from?
Just a little.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, racial identity was like just identity, right? Being a teenager, like you said, and growing up. And I grew up in mostly Whitesville, USA, and different. Every time we moved, Dad, we weren't in the military, but Dad had a job where he's a salesman, and he had the opportunity to move. And in his eyes, he saw that as an opportunity for his kids to see the different parts of the United States, and mostly East Coast. Atlanta was the most south we've been, and upstate Maine, and two different places, towns in Massachusetts and then Colorado. And so the experience of having to be raised in a place where everybody reminds you that you don't belong will, I think, throw you into a identity crisis way earlier than most kids are going through it. Yeah, we didn't have any tools.
Well, it sounds like every time you moved, you had to reestablish also.
Yeah, that's right.
So you say you didn't have any tools. And I guess, is there anybody else you met who had also been adopted? Was there some sort of adoption organization? Was there any sort of resource growing up in that way?
No. There were picnics when we were first placed. When we were first adopted, we lived in Wayland, Massachusetts, and the adoption agency that placed us was an agency that offered picnics in the summertime for all the adoptive families that they had placed and had matched. But because we moved within, I think, a year and a half of being adopted, we didn't get to go to those things. And then, you know, my parents, like every other parent that adopted in the 70s and the 80s, and I'm going to even argue most also in the 90s, had this philosophy of clean slate adoptions. And that is, you adopt this kid and you act as if you gave birth to them. You don't treat them any differently. You wrap them up into your family. Don't talk about race. Don't talk about adoption. Don't talk about birth family. Don't do any of that. Don't give anybody any language. So then the isolation is even that more, that more toxic. Mm-hmm. And they'll be fine.
Did you try to bring up that conversation with your parents? You know, can we talk about my adoption a little more?
I didn't even have that language. I didn't, yeah. You know, it was, yes, in my own little Ostrid way. I definitely was, I was mad. I was mad that I was being teased. I was, definitely had, I was the kid who is always expressing my feelings outwardly, getting into trouble and getting into fights. And when, like, mostly it was more about race than it was about adoption. Mm-hmm. There was some adoption teasing and your parents aren't really your parents. Why don't you go back to Colombia? Why are you here? And yeah, the teasing, but most of the teasing had to do with being not white. Mm-hmm. And so we would come home. I would come home and I'd get kicked off the bus because I got into a fight. And my parents said, "Why did you get kicked off the bus? What happened?" And I said, "Well, I, you know, beat this kid up because he said to my sister, 'Salt and pepper don't match,' when she was wanted to sit next to a white kid on the bus that she had a crush on. So I got into a fight." And they were like, "Well, don't do that." And that was it, right? So there were plenty of opportunities that I was talking, or I would, you know, ask questions about, do we know anything about my birth mom? And I think at that point, we weren't even using that lingo. So I think I said my real mom. I've lived my whole life with people asking me, "Do you know who your real mom is?" That's, you know, and assuming that they're meaning my birth mother. So I think I brought the topic up because my parents didn't have any tools on how to talk about this. They thought that by talking about it, they were creating more problems. So they just didn't.
I see. Well, and it sounds like the thing you were saying about they're encouraged to treat adoption like a clean slate, like these are your kids and
act as if you gave birth to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that might be for some people best intentioned if they feel like, I don't want to keep telling my child that they're adopted, or if we talk about it, they may feel
othered.
Less or othered. Yeah. But then that's contrary to what's needed. You need to talk about it.
Right. Right.
So it sounds like this and much of your life inspired Adoption Mosaic. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about your company and kind of how you got there.
Yeah. So Adoption Mosaic started off as a 501c3 in 2005. And I started it with three other women. I was working at the Oregon Post Adoption Resource Center, which is a local organization offering adoption education and referrals and information. That was not a placement agency. And really in my career, I've worked at adoption agencies, placement agencies, and it wasn't a good fit. And so I then volunteered one summer at Orr Park, and then there was a position that opened up, and then I worked there. The challenge was at the time that Orr Park was only allowed to serve families that had adopted through the child welfare system. So literally, if Norm and Chris, my parents, my adoptive parents, if I was little and they had called and finally found a resource that might help them with books and library and resources and talk to a family support specialist, as a family support specialist, I would have had to say, "Sorry, you didn't adopt through the child welfare system." Mm. And the U.S. child welfare system were only funded to support families, which felt really unethical, as you can imagine, knowing that there were so many families out there that needed the support. And I even tried to make the argument at the state level where we were getting our RFP that you got to open this up because guess what's going to happen to these international kids or these private domestic kids that are growing up and saying, I need, or the parents are realizing that they need support. Those kids will become a part of the system and we need to help these families. So that is why we started Adoption Mosaic, was because there was a need. It was clear. My boss at the time, Claudia Hutchinson, if you're listening, I tell this story all the time. She's amazing. She was my supervisor at the time. And she and I kind of had this unspoken agreement that I could help these families, but not on ORPARC time. We had the funding was the funding, and she helped me work around it. And she's like, you know how to access the database and the resources for these families, and tell them you'll take the calls during your lunch hour or at, and give them your cell phone. And I did that, and I did that enough that then some of the organizations, large organizations that focus on international, like FCC, Families with Children from China, started hearing about my work. I specialize in transracial adoption education and support. And so they would ask me to come to their conference and talk. And then we just started building a little database and realized, and then there were three adoptive moms who were kind of the behind the scenes 501c3 support people, you know, all the getting our legal status as a 501c3 and doing all the paperwork and the fundraising and the board, and that they were managing all of that. And I was just going out and presenting and talking and doing programs. So we did that for 10 years, ran Adoption Mosaic. I quit my job at ORPARC and did Adoption Mosaic full time. And we didn't have, well, I'm just a little plug here. We didn't have a rational unicorn in the classes, and we didn't have the support that we needed to really understand the need for the, or we understood the need for the funding. that's for sure. We just didn't have the infrastructure within our board to be able to do the fundraising enough that we could hire, and I'm going to say air quotes, a real ED. And it was grassroots. I was the ED by default because I was the only one who was batshit crazy enough to work 80 hours a week and get paid for five. But, or maybe I think we got me up to minimum wage for 20 hours, which was really a huge feat for us as an organization. And I had a support person, Shalice, who is also an adoptee, and then I found my birth mother, and my life as Astrid as I knew it no longer existed. The person who didn't know where she came from or why she came into care, or and the rug was pulled out from under me, and I lost my sense of self, and we decided to close the organization. It's crazy because here we had this organization to support, right? I think in my entire life and in my entire career, I've been a little bit ahead of the curve because I'm loud and I got things to say and I got questions. And if there aren't answers, I realize, okay, I'll go figure out the answers and then I'm going to tell everybody else about the answers, right? So they don't have to go through what I went through. So there just weren't a whole lot of people ahead of me who had gone through what I went through as far as finding my birth mother and finding out our history and how she lost us.
What year was that?
That was 11 years ago. So in 2000, so I found her, tried to keep the organization afloat. And then within, I think, 2.5 years, we were talking about closing it. And then within the third year of we closed the organization, I got a divorce and I was a single mom. And I had been partnered and married for 23 years.
Yeah, that's lots of changes.
Yeah.
So how did your mom, meeting her, affect your life? How did that, you had mentioned either losing a sense of self or having a shifted sense of self.
Yeah. So finding her wasn't expected. We weren't expecting to find her. It was kind of happen chance. And we went I was married at the time. My ex-husband and I and daughter, who was 8 years old, I think, at the time, we flew to Bucaramanga to go. My daughter wanted to see where I was born and the town, and we would take her every other year to Cartagena, which is the coast and beautiful oceans and water, and we would vacation there because I wanted her to grow up knowing how to speak Spanish and being in Colombia and not being afraid of. I grew up my whole life being afraid of.
Is your ex-husband Colombian?
No, he's Italian. Born and raised in Italy. I speak fluent Italian, but I don't speak Spanish. And which is really funny because when I call it birth mother Spanish, which is only Spanish that only a mother could understand, because I use a lot of my Italian. They're so similar. So I use a lot of my Italian to speak to my mom in Spanish. Mm-hmm. What was your question?
So it's okay. No, you're doing a great job. So 11 years ago, you met her. I mean, how did you find her? And then what was that like?
Yeah. So there was actually the Oregonian, when I got back, somebody in the Oregon, because I was working at, I was still running Adoption Mosaic, and I did a kind of a, people had followed my story and found out that I had found her when I was there. So when I came back, we did a big party, and the party was for me to just tell my whole community at once, because everybody was wanting to, you know, hear the story. And somebody at the Oregonian got wind of the story, who picked it up and came and interviewed me. She interviewed me, and we sat at Powell's bookstore on Hawthorne for 3 hours. And then she said, "We're not done, are we?" And I said, "I don't think so." And she said, "Let's set up another interview." So we interviewed again for another 3 hours and then another 3 hours. So it was a 9-hour interview of just kind of talking about. So I just want to say that to say there's the article, if you could add that to the show notes or whatever, so people could read the details of how we found her. But in a nutshell, we put an ad in the newspaper in Bucaramanga, and we had gone to the orphanage, we had talked to social workers, we had done a little bit of, you know, the regular things that you would do. Is there a file? And we went to the State Department, and no, there was no information. And then I said at the last day, I said, "You know what? My whole life I've thought it, because I've always wanted to find."
That's what I was going
to
ask you. What prompted?
Yeah.
At that point, trying to find her versus earlier.
Yeah. So I've been looking for her, not super in depth, or you know, not a deep dive in searching for her, but I had been searching for her pretty much since I got off the plane, whether it was emotionally. Or mentally and then physically searching for her. And so the actual searching for her was a 15-year process. And when I say a 15-year process, like putting us adoptees, it's like, this is a roller coaster, right? For us to, I explain it as you put your big toe in it and you realize the water is above 103 and it hurts. So you take it out and then you'd say, okay, I'm going to wait. And then next time, you know, maybe I'll Google my name that's in my files. Maybe I'll go on Facebook. And so...
Is part of that there's maybe an assumption that she didn't want you, or that she did something bad to not be able to deserve you? Was there some sort of like emotion towards her?
As far as why I stopped?
Correct.
When I stopped, yeah. No, I think when I stopped because I was doing this in isolation. I didn't have a community. I didn't have people saying, "Oh, go look here, go do that." And I didn't, there wasn't a book or a person who helped me say, "This is the next step. This is what I would do next." So I would Google her name and Facebook and, you know, knowing that it's very possible her name had been falsified, or, you know, that I didn't have the accurate information. My sister and I it was clear that our file had been falsified. So it was clear that whatever was on this paperwork was very likely. Our birth certificates were falsified, our everything about us. And so, like, where do you start? How do you go find somebody, right? So I had this idea in my head that if I ever got to close enough to actually maybe finding her and I couldn't find her, that I would go to the newspaper and I would just get a classified ad and put it in the back of the newspaper. And so I went, the last 3 days we were there, I told this friend that we were with, that it's a funny story how we met him, but he's a Colombian from and lives in Bucaramanga. And I said, you know, I was thinking about like, okay, we're kind of done. How about we just go into the newspaper? And he's like, oh, that's a really great idea. Okay, so in Colombia they have, I'm just going to say like the New York Times version of a newspaper, and then they have the Inquirer version of a newspaper. And of course, I didn't want to be in the Inquirer, right? Who wants to be in the Inquirer? So I suggested we went to the New York Times version, and he said, no, we're not going to do that. The common folks don't read that. Your birth mother is going to be reading the Inquirer if she's going to read anything. And so I was like, fine. So we went to that newspaper. And I went to the counter and I had a picture, the black and white pictures, passport pictures, our Colombian, original Colombian passport pictures. And I slid them in and I said, we're to the window of the receptionist. And I said, I'm looking for our mom. And could we just get an ad? And how much would that cost? She said, oh, hold on 1 second. She takes the pictures and goes to the back, talks to her boss. And the boss says, no, we'll run an article on her. So then they took me in the back. They interviewed me, asked me some questions. This was right around Christmas. It wasn't going to go to print until Monday. This was a Friday, so we had all weekend, whatever. And, you know, I think at that point, I did this interview and I was like, okay, I'm going to get on a plane in 3 days or 4 days and I'm kind of done. And, you know, maybe this article will get in the right hands at some point and there's a contact number for somebody to reach out to us. So that Monday morning that it went to print, by 10 o'clock, four women had called in and said, and one of those four women was our mom. And the reason that there were so many people who called in and saw those pictures was because there was so much corruption that was happening at that time. I mean, for many years of, and so the story was that my sister and I had been left with a trusted friend while our mother went and got a job, and we were kidnapped and sold in the black market of adoption. That's what I mean by my identity and who I was and who I thought I was really stripped from me in that moment of hearing that story coming from her. So we went out, met her. She told us the story of what had happened.
I mean, what was that like?
Horrific. Like, what is that? I mean, the things that were going on in my mind in that like split second was how does everybody who was involved in this adoption, right? How do we reconcile this? How do we find healing? How do we move on? How do we get to know each other or not get to know each other? Like, and she had spent 36 years looking for us.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, you're a mom too. So if you can imagine your child or two children being taken away from you and then not knowing where they are,
you'd spend the rest of your life looking for them. Yeah, absolutely. Right. And so seeing her grief and her, and the fact that my sister and I had not retained our Spanish, we had not been given any resources or tools. So I'm using my Italian and trying to understand. We have this translator. My daughter's there who speaks fluent Spanish. My ex-husband is there. It was like this whirlwind of a moment of, I think the very first moment was, I don't know to believe what to believe and what not to believe, right? And then there was a couple pieces to this story that fell into place where another woman had called who was there at the time when it was her mother who took us. She and her mom, she was in her 20s, a young woman. She was arguing with her mom saying, you can't take them. And my sister grew up my whole life my sister telling me, I think it was our mom and our grandma that had an argument. And all I know is that our mom loves us and wanted us. Mm. And so this was this woman who my sister had told me about. And she always said, I think it might have been our mother, but I don't remember exactly. You lose language, you lose memory with language. And so, yeah, so it's...
She's a stranger, but she's your mom. Did you embrace? Like, was it...
Oh, in that moment?
Yeah. I mean, what was that like?
Yeah. I was numb, you know, yeah. Michael. I was numb to like, oh, okay, I'm your daughter. Let's hug. She was wailing. I describe it as... You've seen it in movies, old movies, where an Italian woman is like leaning over a gravestone or something and wailing and crying in this. I think there's a word for it, but I don't remember the word. Anyway, she was doing that in my ear, right, as she's hugging me. And I think I was just in shock. And my daughter was there. And, I mean, we were all there trying to... the language piece was a big one. I wasn't sure. I didn't see the resemblance. And so I was like, I wonder if we really are. Like, I mean, I wasn't willing to attach to this, even to the idea that she was my mom, until the DNA test came back.
How did the other three women not go away, but you knew that one of them wasn't? Like four women had called.
Mm-hmm.
How did you know that she was the one?
So we had a little bit of information about the two of us that we told our translator and the person who was helping us that were kind of personal things about us. There was one piece that she said, no, I left you. You were very, very healthy. And I arrived to the United States needing a new kidney or not needing a new, having, I was born with three kidneys and I had to have two of them removed because you're not supposed to have two kidneys in one side, right? And so they weren't functioning properly. So one of the questions to determine whether she was our mom or not was like, was the little one sick? And she's like, no, I left two very healthy babies. We were also living on the streets. We were also, she was, you know, running away from our extremely abusive father with the two of us trying to keep us safe and living on benches and living in really unhealthy spaces. And so I don't know that she even had the wherewithal to be able to notice how sick I was. And I was really sick. But yeah, there was just some questions about that. Mia had told me, my sister had told me, and that we gave to the translator, and he asked her some questions, and she even said, "I have been taken by so many searchers because she would hire a searcher about every 5 years, trying to find us, and she was like, don't think that I'm not gonna." demand a DNA. I need proof that these are my
girls. That's what she said, or that's what you said?
She said that. And I have to say, I was so relieved because I work with adoptees who, I want you to imagine your entire life never being around anybody that not only didn't look like you, but didn't even, no racial mirrors, right? Mm. And then you go to your birth country where everybody looks like you. And it's so easy for you to be like, there's my mom. There's my mom. Oh my gosh, that could be my mom. That could be my mom. I mean, even in grocery store lines, any brown, you know, person who looked Latina, I said, oh, maybe she's my mom. No. Okay, she's probably still in Colombia. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's... And so it's really common for us to attach to the idea that this person is absolutely, without a doubt, your relative or whatever. They look like me. Well, if you've never been around people who racial mirrors, everybody in Colombia, not everybody, but there's a huge diversity of people in Colombia. But you get what I mean as far as
And so you took the DNA test. And is this is just an extension of a trip that you already had? You were in the area? So you had to stay a little bit?
No, we got on a plane. We got on a plane. We went to a clinic. They did a swab they did a blood test. And I think they did a swab as well. But she really was very adamant that she had no interest in attaching or becoming close to somebody that was not her daughter or daughters. And so, so we basically had the DNA test came back, I want to say 10 days later. It was during the New Year's and Christmas and all of that. So it took a little bit. Everybody who saw Carmenza, who's our birth mom, everybody who saw her would look at me and say, "Oh my God, you found your mom. That's crazy." And I would be like, results haven't come back yet. And I think that some of that was protecting, you know, this little Astrid, and like, I'm not gonna, I can't say she's my mom until I know she's my mom, like scientifically.
What about your sister? Did she know about all this?
I called her in the hotel the night that she answered and I said, "Mia, I think I found our mom." And Mia's not wanted to search, and you know, I navigate that with other families and other adoptees as well. When you have one sibling who wants to search and the other who's like, "Yeah, no, that's not my thing." I think part of that 15 years that you were asking about was also recognizing and acknowledging that my sister, I was forcing something onto my sister, whether I wanted to or not. Like, and I even remember saying to her, like, "Mia, what am I supposed to do? Like, what if I find somebody? Am I like, do you not want me to tell you?" And she's like, no, of course. I mean, can tell me." And I was like, "Okay, well, but I'm forcing something onto you that you're clearly saying, I have my closure. I don't need this." And I think it pulled out the rug out from both of us, from under us.
Well, and then you mentioned that after that happened, your life changed. You had kind of a moment of
crisis.
Tell me about that.
Finding out that the beginnings of your life, somebody fought so hard to keep you, somebody wanted you so badly, right, and that you were lost through a system, is a very different narrative than what we were raised to how to talk about adoption. Adoptions are because people can't parent, or they're not healthy people to parent, or they're, and you know, we were living on the streets and we were living in poverty and we were, but the point of her wanting us was so fundamental. I never felt like our mom didn't want us. Neither Mia, my sister, nor I ever felt like, "Oh, she didn't care about us. She just threw us away." Mm-hmm. We never had those feelings. So I think for me, hearing how she lost us and the work that I do working in adoptions was like, what am I actually doing? What is my purpose? What does it mean to educate? What does it mean to support and truth speaking? Like, what does that mean when you found out that I have what I have, I am the person I am, and it started from this corruption within an industry that I work in? There was a need. There's a supply and a demand, right? There's black market babies come through this system because there is a supply and a demand issue that is needing to be fixed. And when we know, I gave you the statistic that 86% of first time adopters adopt because of infertility, and we didn't have a system that said, you're not adopting a child to make them yours. You're providing a home, you're providing love, and you're helping this child become whoever they're supposed to become. Right. And in adoptions, that's a weird thing to say, right? Like, who was I supposed to become? And our mom raised, we have a little sister, and she raised, who is at 11 years ago, she was 18. So she's going to be turning 30. math. So
how frequently since you met your mom have you talked to her, seen her?
Yeah, so I try to go down, minus the pandemic, about every 2 years since I've met her. Try to talk to her about once every 2 weeks to a month. There was a period of time where I had to push pause. It was really hard for me. One, the language barrier, but also she cried all the time. And of course she did. She missed us. She was reuniting, right? So, and that was really hard for me. I carried the burden of her loss.
Has your sister met her or talked to her?
Yep. She went down 2 years after I found our mom and we went together. And yeah. And I don't share my sister's story. This is one of the complexities of storytelling and adoption. It's like, how do I tell my story without exposing, you know, other people's stories? And my sister's is one that I don't share. Mm-hmm. My mom has given me permission to share and knows the work that I do. And and my adoptive moms, my adoptive parents. And yeah, but Those are people who feel very comfortable with me sharing parts of how they're connected to this, and my sister not so much.
Well, thank you for sharing all that. So it's a lot, but it's, you know, I think you're doing great. You know, I think that you've used the good, bad, and ugly of your life to push forward and help other people. So I guess, how does what you went through, trauma, lack of resources, what you learned, how does that all sort of translate into how you help people now?
Yeah. I would say that lived experience fuels everything that I do. And it fuels it, but what really keeps the fire going are the other logs that I put on, and that is the lived experience of other people and having a really rich community that has very different stories and very different experiences that I do. And so my personal lived experience definitely drove me to, there are a lot of victims in this story, a lot. And I struggle saying this, and yet I'm trying to figure out how to say it in a concise way, where I believe that my adoptive parents are also a part of the victims of the system, and they weren't given any resources, any tools. What does it mean for my parents to navigate that they raised two girls that at the expense of a woman losing her babies in this way and spending 36 years looking for, like my parents, like wrapping their heads around that. Everybody who is a part of my life has to, that is really close to me, has to come to some sort of terms around that, right? And so the work that I do is creating space to talk about this. I don't have an agenda on saying that you should think the way I think, or you should be anti-adoption, or you should be pro-adoption, or you should be any of that. I just know that there's such a lack of spaces of education. There's more and more that is coming about where there are spaces to talk more about this. But there are very few places where you can talk about your journey of being an adopted person and not having the person who you're talking to have their own opinions, that they have an agenda. We talk a lot about racial isolation and adoptee isolation for those of us who are transracially adopted. Most transracial adoptees that I know were raised in racial isolation. Almost 100% of the adoptees that I know were raised in adoptee isolation, which means we didn't have other adoptees to talk to. We didn't have the language. We didn't know how to. We didn't know how to. And in our 20s, we become critical thinkers about the world. That just happens across the board, regardless of whether you're adopted or not. But when you have to be a critical thinker about your identity and your existence as a human being, that will that's when the rug gets pulled out from under you. And we usually go through that in our mid-20s. And that kind of crisis of our identity, racial identity, or whatever struggle identity we have, right? It gets usually in our 20s. We move out at 18, some of us do. And then, you know, between 18 and 26, we're still developing into adulthood. And that's usually where that is happening. And we're once again in isolation. So
you had closed your nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You met your mom. You went through all this. You went through a divorce, getting used to being a single mother. And then what was sort of the catalyst of, I'm going to reopen this? And then when you did, I imagine it's somewhat of a re-envisioning of what it was.
Yeah, with a twist. Yeah, for sure. So closed the organization and in 2015, then we actually did hire a business consultant because I had said to the board of directors, hey, guys, I know you probably might not believe me, but I have every intention to relaunch this organization in some capacity. I'm not done. And all of them were just dear friends and amazing people and adoptive parents and birth parents and adoptees and just the community. And they were like, yeah, sure you will. Yeah, you can have all the intellectual property. Take it. It's yours anyway. It always has been. So really supportive. I think they all were probably worried about my mental health at that time of like, we want to support you. So I did that. We hired a business consultant who said, there'll be brand confusion if you try to relaunch Adoption Mosaic as an LLC. You need to hold off and give it some years. And so I did, and I waited 4 years. And the November before the pandemic, 2019, November's Adoption Awareness Month. And so I was going to relaunch it during that month. Website wasn't ready. Okay, I'll wait. Okay, now let's just wait till the top of the year. That'll be easy. January hits, we're still not ready. And then the pandemic hits and I was like, I'm just going to wait till this blows over. And I was really fortunate to have a dear friend who knew Zoom and she said, no, don't do that. Let's launch it right now. Mm-hmm. And the pandemic is as horrific as it has been for in so many ways, it was the best thing that ever happened to Adoption Mosaic. We have people from all over the country. We do everything online. We do some in-person adoptee events here in Portland. We do adoptee events in Seattle and adoptee events in Denver. Those are the three cities that we are most.
And what kind of services do you offer?
So the adoptee services, we do bringing our adoptee community together in storytelling, and we do a panel every month, which is our most well-attended program. It's on Zoom, second Saturday of the month, and it's four adoptees with one alternate panelist that is talking about a very specific topic. And we have anywhere between 75 to 120 people attend those panels every month and bring people. I get to bring adoptees from, I've been in this industry doing this work since I was 18. And so 30 plus years, I have community and contacts from people all over the country that really fortunate that so many of them love this programming that we're doing for our adoptee community. We open it up to anybody, but adoptees are the only ones who are allowed to engage in the chat or ask questions because we call it an adoptee-centered space. So non-adoptees can listen and learn and watch what happens when we interact with each other around these specific topics. We also offer trainings. We have three workshops for parents, people who are interested in adopting, people who are actively parenting, and then we seasoned parents. And the seasoned parents are, as my parents have taken seasoned parents, it's for all the parents who are like, I want to catch up. My kid is asking me to hold space to talk about things I don't know how to talk about. And I really don't want to sit in a class with some 20, 30-year-old people who are thinking about adopting. So we created a course for those parents. And then pizza, I have an outdoor pizza party oven that I built. So we have pizza parties all the time, whenever we can. Yeah, with our adoptee community.
And do you think that the services you offer speak to what you would have wanted when you were young, or have you thought, have you had a reflective moment about that?
Yeah, I think they're what I want for my myself now. You know, this is the work that I do with parents is helping the parents create an environment in which I definitely needed when I was little ostrich needed. And now it's, and there's so many more resources, right? So it's like I have this, all of these resources that I can share with these families and help them learn how to talk about race. White, and I have a lot of white families that adopt children of race and of different race other than white, and have them learn about how do you incorporate talking about race? How do you incorporate talking about birth family or extended family or open adoption, closed adoption? When do you go back to your birth, your child's birth country? Do you retain the language? You know, all of these things. There's a, yeah, all of those things were resources that I definitely needed. But I feel like we're also serving our adoptee community. I think your question about what's the biggest difference between the 501c3 and the LLC for me is that I am so clear that we are a adoptee-centered organization and everything else we do is secondary.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Also, thanks for the work that you do.
Yeah, thank you.
So I have five questions for you. I ask everybody.
Okay.
I'm don't ready. Get nervous.
I'm wiggling in my seat right now. Okay.
So the first one is, what is your favorite childhood memory?
Okay. Should have emailed these to me ahead of time. Favorite childhood memory. Probably camping with my parents, my family. We camped a lot. Dad taught me how to survive in the woods. And
that sounds fun.
Yeah.
What is a quote or a mantra that you live by?
What's great about this problem? That's my quote.
That's your quote?
That's my quote.
What's great about this problem?
I always ask myself when shit hits the fan, what is great about this problem?
In terms of like a silver lining or?
Yeah. Or what can I do with this? Or how does this, how can I hold space for this and benefit from it?
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
What have you been watching or reading lately?
I'm really dyslexic, so I don't read unless I have to. So reading, very little, watching. I watched The Woman King. I don't watch series very often, but I watched The Woman King without knowing that it was dripping with adoption. Yeah. If you haven't seen it,
I haven't seen it. I heard it's really good.
It is really good. Viola Davis is amazing.
What keeps you up at night?
Adoption Mosaic.
Those are the questions. See, you did a great job.
Wow,
and
okay.
Then finally, just are there any shout outs you want to give? And then how can people find you?
Yeah, easy to find us, adoptionmosaic.com. It handles on everything, Facebook, Instagram, blah, 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 Adoption Mosaic. And shout out to my adoptee community who and the people who are building this alongside me. And it's not, I'm not doing this alone. And there's, we've got a team. Shalise Gizaki is my right-hand woman, a Korean adoptee herself, who has been involved since the 501c3 days, moved, took a break to have babies, and then moved over to the LLC with me, and just my right-hand person, and all the staff at Adoption Mosaic who's making this happen, and just the adoptees that are out there listening and maybe feeling isolated and feeling like they don't have community. No matter where you are in the country or in the world, you do. And all you need to do is give me a call or you know, message me an email, and we'll help you find that community wherever you are.
Thank you so much for doing this podcast, telling your story, being a great community member, all the things.
Yeah, ditto. Thank you for your work. Yeah.
Thank you.
So glad we found each other. See, it's everywhere. Reunions.